Shabbat Shalom. Welcome to this week's Living Torah. And before I start, I wasn't going to put this in, and it's just like I can't get away from it this morning. I actually started the camera roll here a couple times, and it just wouldn't work. So I guess this morning I'm supposed to put a couple things in here. First of all, there's a couple things that are out there this week. One of them is, I just saw a few minutes ago, is very disturbing to me. It is a comparison by Bill Cosby. And if you've ever been, I enjoyed Bill Cosby growing up as a kid, and I had a lot of respect for the man. But he just put out a video, an interview, I guess, in where he says that, well, I'm a Christian, but we should learn some things from Islam, from the Muslim faith. And I found that very, very disturbing, that here's a man that's looked at as a leader and is just totally blinded to the situations that are going on around us. And I guess what is disturbing to me about this so much is, as I said, the word blindness. This, it seems that a veil is being just over many people's eyes, spiritually, physical eyes even, I guess. But it seems that we're seeing today a greater level of deception than I've ever seen in my lifetime. That people are not even aware of the truth. They're not even concerned about what is truth, and the dividing lines that are being drawn in this day. I just we've had so much talk, and I've had some conversations with people just in the last few days. We've had so much talk about the end times through the past years, and I've been a part of some of that. And I think that we've reached a place that many people have become so dull in their senses that they're not even seeing what's really happening out there. And so for you and for me, I guess the challenge in this is, don't allow yourself to become part of that group that just says, well, I guess nothing's going on around us, and I just need to tune it all out. Because that is a very, very, that when we come to that place, that we just tune everything out and we don't see. And I'm not talking about keeping up with every news article that's going on. I'm not talking about, walking around with the sky is falling all the time. We got to walk in a balance of this. But please do not be those that are just kind of tuning out, because there's some serious things that are happening that are kind of behind the scenes. The other thing, and I'm probably going to get in a little trouble for this on, who knows, on a few different things, but I read this morning a comparison to the new Superman movie. And I just saw the other day that the new Superman movie was coming out. I'm really out of the loop when it comes to movies. I really don't care that much about them. But this comparison was one of comparing... I just use the words that they use, comparing Superman, the new Superman movie, to Jesus and the gospel. And it was a comparison of how many things are written into this movie that are things like the Superman character that is in the movie is a son of a carpenter. His father had a beard, which that was kind of interesting. He was 30 years old when he became Superman. He fought against an evil character with a goatee, and the list went on and on about these comparisons. And I would imagine somewhere along the way, somebody's going to come up with this wonderful idea that the reason that everyone should see this movie is, and I'm not anti-movie, I really don't care. But the reason people should see this is so they can see the gospel portrayed before them. That to me, and that's not going to happen. I guarantee you, somebody along the way, you will hear that some church took their youth group to the Superman movie like they did with Batman, in order to teach them what the gospel is all about. Let us not, in this day, allow ourselves to cheapen in any way what the gospel truly is. Let us not allow others around us take a stand. If people make stupid statements regarding things like that, and I think we're going to see it. Take a stand and say, how dare you? How dare you cheapen what my Messiah has done for me? We need to be a people who are reverencing the work of Messiah in our lives. And maybe if we would raise that work to a new level, then we would see more of the fruit of our labors, not allowing his work to be diminished by some silly movie. And so I felt like that had to be said this morning. Don't know why, but maybe it helped you out. Matthew chapter 20, and we're going to go to verse 17. As Yeshua was going to Jerusalem, he took the 12 Talmudim aside by himself and said to them as he went on their way, "We are now going up to Jerusalem, where the Son of Man will be handed over to the head Kohanim and the religious leaders." I'm inserting those words because of my attitude toward Stern's translation there. "They will sentence him to death and turn him over to the Goyim, the Romans, who will jeer at him, beat him, and execute him on a stake as a criminal. But on the third day, he will be raised." Now, you know, imagine these disciples. They're coming to Jerusalem. They've done this many times. They've been walking with Messiah for somewhere around 2 years. They've come with him for Passovers. You know, the first Passover that was not the last one, right? They've been with him because it is the Torah for him and the disciples to go to Jerusalem for Passover, Shavuot, for Sukkot. So probably at least two times they have been with him during these times. Now, what was it like? I mean, consider just the thought process for a moment. What was it like to celebrate Sukkot with Yeshua in Jerusalem? That there's one that your mind kind of goes on overload in a few different directions. So what are they expecting? They're expecting to, once again, they're on their way to Jerusalem, and they're going there. It's a little while before Passover, but this is the last trip they're taking toward Jerusalem, and they're going to be, you know, their mind is kind of heading in that direction already. And so there's some anticipation that's going on. There's a number of things. Maybe they're daydreaming along the way. And he says to them these words. Now, what do they hear? They hear the last words, which is kind of a human thing, is it not? That when somebody says something to us, sometimes if our mind is wandering somewhere, it takes us a moment to kind of, okay, well, wait a minute, wait, stop there. Well, they didn't stop. They just grabbed the last words that Yeshua said. "But on the third day, he will be raised." So immediately, their mind goes to, hey, we're going to Jerusalem this time, and we're going for the purpose of him taking his rightful position as the king. He is going to defeat the oppression of our day. You're going to be the king, and we're going to get back at everybody. Isn't this kind of what the concept of Messiah was in that day? And I dare say that this may be a little bit of the concept of what Yeshua's return is in some people's lives. That in Israel 2,000 years ago, the same as in Egypt hundreds of years earlier, the same as today in our modern society. What do we have? We have oppression. Especially in America, I speak for where I am today, we see this oppression. We've had so many things in the news lately. These scandals that happen that seem to come out every single day. Here recently, the NSA and the wiretapping and everything is recorded that you do. And there's people, well, we need to take the battery out of our cell phone. If you think that's gonna alleviate something, go for it, okay? But I can tell you, the amount of information that is collected on you today, for what purpose? To oppress in the end. But we need to not be looking at the return of Messiah as has been through the centuries, has the way that they looked at him when he was alive, when he was on this earth, alive, he's still alive, on this earth 2,000 years ago. What were they looking for? They were looking for a conquering king. They were under the bondage of Rome at the time. And there was this attitude that we need a king who can deliver us from this political and religious system that we find ourselves in. And then we can take over from them and we can get back at them. There is today a little bit of this left in Mormonism. If you've ever studied Mormonism, and of course I talk about this quite, not quite often, but at times, Mormonism has a pretty rough track record, let's put it that way, in America. There were a lot of Mormons that were killed, and I would never condone such a practice just because somebody believes different than we do, okay? But Mormonism, if you go back and look at it, the killings, what happened to the Mormons, was pretty atrocious. But today, there is a lingering element in Mormonism that if we can ever get control, we're going to get you back for what you did. Do we not see this in all kinds of racism today? Do we not see this in... there's an element in the African-American community that is... it's not about... they're looking at slavery. And again, I would never condone what happened many years ago. But at the same time, I cannot be... I should not be required to pay for the sins of somebody else. And so it's not just righting the wrong, it's you're going to pay us back for the wrong. Okay? And this is the attitude that was very prevalent in Israel 2,000 years ago. And so they were looking for Messiah to set up his kingdom in order that the Romans, the Goyim of that day, could then be put under oppression and be paid back for what they had done. This raises kind of an interesting question in the midst of this. Here it is. Consider for a moment the return of Messiah. Now, this is a subject that I talked to the Purify 2013 group a couple of weeks ago. This is a subject that has been a part of my life even before I came to a knowledge of Messiah. Back in 1972-73, I remember sitting around with a group of young people doing a lot of things that we shouldn't be doing. And somebody in the midst of that said, "Hey, did you hear that they've said that Jesus is going to return this year?" And I don't know about everybody else. I have no recollection of the conversation that went on after that moment. But I can tell you that back in 72, 73, when I was sitting there and I heard that, something happened inside of me. Something kind of triggered. And so it scared me. It didn't scare me enough to get my life straightened out, but it did put a certain fear in me. And even back just really within weeks or months after coming to Messiah in back in 1986, the thought of the return of the Messiah was something that was a driving issue, a driving motivation, I guess would be a better way to say that. And I can tell you it still is today. But I want to ask a question regarding the return of Messiah. Why do you want him to return? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Why do you want Messiah to return? Now, I heard one teacher years ago that said this: the only people that he had really ever seen that were totally desiring the kingdom to come, totally desiring the return of Yeshua, were people who were terminally ill or heavily in debt. And I can see that, because I've been around some people that are so heavily in debt that the only way that they would be free of that is the return of Messiah. I just wonder, you know, if they'd done that on their own and for all kinds of the wrong reasons, will that debt go on over into the millennium? I don't know. I doubt it. But, you know, just kind of interesting to think about, that a person going to have 1,000 years to take to pay for what they had done. But there is an element of truth here. The point that I want you to consider is, what is your motivation for praying the prayer that Yochanan prayed on the Isle of Patmos? Even so, come quickly, Yahweh Yeshua. Why do you desire his return? Is it because you're tired of the aches and pains of growing old? Is it because you have too much debt? Is it because life has thrown you a number of curveballs that you weren't really looking you didn't really want to catch? And life is just not going the way that you desire it to go? Is it because we look at the religious system around us and think, oh, I want that, you know, I just can't stand Christmas and Easter anymore. And I wish somebody would come along and destroy all the artificial Christmas trees and the bunnies that lay eggs. Is it because of the political situation that we find the world around us in? Or do we desire his return for the specific reason of seeing his face, of having him seated in his rightful position in Jerusalem? The Torah going forth from Jerusalem, not to get people back for what they've done, not so that we can walk into a Walmart and not have to see Christmas trees, but the Torah going forth from Jerusalem so that people will come to a freedom, the freedom that the Torah brings forth. Do we want him to return so that he can destroy our enemies, or so that we can worship him? I think it's a good question for us each to ask ourselves, because the root of the answer to that question really reveals our motivation today for serving him. Why are we serving him today? Is it for the blessing? Is it because of the benefits that we receive? Is it because we get to hang around, you know, this group of people or that group of people? Or are we serving him today just because of our love for him? Just because of our love for the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Are we serving him so that we can get a free trip to Israel? Are we serving Him just because He is? It's a good place to kind of spend some time considering today. Well, in the Scripture, this is what happened at the end of that. Then Zabdi's sons came to Yeshua with their mother. She bowed down, begging a favor from him. Now, who are these people? If we go over to Mark chapter 3, we see a list of the disciples. And in Mark chapter 3, let me get to it here, we see Yaakov ben Zabdi and Yochanan, Yaakov's brother. To them, Yeshua gave the name Benai Regesh, which is thunderers, or sons of thunder, or sons of turmoil, or could actually be translated sons of anger. Now, consider for a moment that Yeshua called these men, all right? There's two of his disciples that he calls them, and he gives them, Yeshua himself, with a capital H, himself, gives these men the nickname sons of anger, sons of turmoil. Why in the world? Why would Yeshua? I mean, couldn't he pick some nice guys, you know? Couldn't he pick some people that kind of have it under control, that have all this self-control and everything else is going? Couldn't he pick some people like that? Instead, he goes out and he picks two men that he's going to give the nickname Sons of Thunder. That gives us hope. It really should give us hope that he's not looking for perfect people. He's looking for people that he can pour himself through and will eventually, in the end, get over themselves and allow him by his Spirit to give them some things that we read over in Galatians called the fruit of the Spirit. Self-control is one of those. So it's always been kind of a funny thing for me that he called these guys, but it just really gives us hope that he was not looking for perfect people. Now, where did they get this from? Okay? Where did they get this Sons of Thunder from? Maybe it's a little play on words that the thunder came from Mama. See, Sons of Thunder, Sons of Turmoil, Sons of Anger. Whose sons are they? They're the sons, could be the sons of turmoil and thunder. It could be that Mrs. Zabdi here is quite the lady. I'll just let you wander around with that one for a few minutes. But it may be that she is, she needs a lot of duct tape, put it that way. We'll just put it that way. She bows down to Yeshua. Okay, a little kind of humility here going on. Begging a favor from him. Now, the question has to be, who is instigating this meeting? All right? Now, we don't know specifically if when Yeshua says to the disciples, but on the third day I will be raised, we don't know if this next verse of verse 20 happened immediately. All right, we kind of want to read into that everything happened right away. Well, it could be that, you know, it could be that their mother, Yaakov and Yochanan, the other Yochanan, the son of thunder, Yochanan, it could be that their mother wasn't even there. I mean, she could have been. It could be that she's not anywhere close, and as they're walking toward Jerusalem, consider this, they go by their house. And, you know, they say, hey, Yeshua, could we go in and talk to our mother for a few minutes? Sure, go right ahead. They go in and talk to Mama and tell Mama, hey, we're going to Jerusalem, and he said to us, something about a third day. Now, I don't remember what the third day thing was all about, but it says what we did here was he's going to be raised. We think he's going to Jerusalem this year to take his place as the king. Mom, you know, there's 12 of us out there. And, you know, we really want to have a special... And Mama just takes it over from there. I mean, I'm reading a lot into the story, but how did it happen? What's going on behind the scenes? Again, as I've taught for how many years, real people, real lives, with the real motivations that we deal with the real problems we deal with, okay, they're no different than you and I. And so Mrs. Zebdi comes out. She bows down, begging a favor from him. And he says, I read this one again this morning, and I just had to kind of stop for a minute and picture Yeshua as he's saying this. What do you want? It's like the pregnant pause at the end. Now, whether he knows, because you know there are times that we see in the scripture that the Father shows, he says, I do nothing except I do what I see my Father do. There are times when he's able to walk into a situation and know exactly what is going on. There are other times, you know, that he walks into a situation with the Pharisees and literally speaks to them that which was on their mind. There are other times this doesn't happen. So could there be a place of a test here for Yeshua himself? Remember the words of Hebrews. He was tested in all points, the same as you and I, but without sin. So even in the midst of some of these things, we need to look for places that Yeshua was tested. And this may be one of them. He says, okay, Mrs. Zebdi, however you pronounce that in Hebrew, what do you want? And she replies, promise that when you become king, these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and one on your left. Okay. Legitimate? Yeah, legitimate question, I think. Actually, it's a good idea. They're bringing forth is they're comparing what will be the reign of Yeshua to what they have seen in a natural sense. That a king, the leader, has those that are in higher authority right next to it. It's like we would put this into America. The president has a vice president, has a secretary of state, has a secretary of defense. Now, you know, we've got 5,000 now different people sitting on the right and left, but the root of this, there are people that have the ear of the president a little closer. There are people that have the ear of a king. And so I can let this question go a little bit in saying that what their mother is asking is in a way kind of a good thing. It's showing, Yeshua, my sons are committed to you. They are so committed to you that they should have, in the end, the honor of sitting at your right and left hands. That's how committed they are to you. And Yeshua kind of lets that all go. And he says to her this. Yeshua answered, you people don't know what you are asking. Now, it's pretty obvious from the next verses that we're going to read on down that all of the disciples are standing there. Can you imagine what is happening? Can you imagine what is going through Peter's mind? I mean, the guy with the sword. Can you imagine what is going through Judas's mind, the guy that would betray him anyway, what in the world are, you know, these guys are starting to murmur a little bit between themselves, just offended by just the question that is being asked. And Yeshua says, "You people don't know what you are asking." Is it possible that the reason that the sons of Zebedee came to their mother and got her involved in this is because this is the conversation that was going on between all 12 of them? Could be. They just had the fortitude to, hey, we're going to get mom involved. We're going to go ahead and step up to the plate and ask him. He says, "You people don't know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup that I am about to drink?" Remember, he's going to Jerusalem. And I'm going to kind of skip over that one a little bit because we're going to go into that in greater detail when we get to Jerusalem and we get to the right in the days before the Passover. And they said to him, "We can." Those words, they didn't have a clue what they were saying. If there's any words in Scripture that ring to me as very hollow, it's these two words. Do you understand the cup that I am about to drink? Can you drink of that same cup? Oh, sure, yeah, we can do that. Very hollow, very flippant, not knowing, not having a clue of what is going to transpire in the days ahead. And I liken that to maybe, do we know? Do we have an idea of what the cup is going to be that we're going to have to drink in the future? See, Yeshua came back at him and he says this. He says, "Yes, you will drink my cup." So he is saying to the disciples, there's something that's going to happen to me when we get to Jerusalem. You don't know anything about it. But in the end, you're going to know all too well. You're going to be all too well acquainted with the cup that I am drinking from. I've done this, and it's been quite some time ago, I think. But I want to just stop right here. And I'd like to read for you. Many of you have heard this before, but I think it's worth going over again in the midst of this. What cup did the disciples drink from? How did they die? I've got a list here. Shimon Kepha, crucified upside down. Andrew, Peter's brother, crucified. Yaakov, beheaded. Yochanan, exiled, died at an old age. Matthew, speared to death. Bartholomew, beaten, then crucified. Philip, crucified. Thomas, speared to death. Simon, crucified. James, stoned to death. Thaddeus, stoned to death. And Judas of Iscariot, of course, suicide by hanging. The only one to live his life to an old age was Yochanan. It is said that he was placed in hot boiling oil and did not die. These sent to the Isle of Patmos, not a picnic by any man's terms. They did drink a cup. in their day. They drank a cup very similar to the cup that Yeshua was going to drink. And I think it's a good place for us to just consider that in all and I know this is a subject that today in many people's lives, people don't even want to hear it. When we talk about tribulation and all this going, there is a group of people that doesn't even want to hear about it anymore because it's been talked about so much. But again, don't be the kind of people that just kind of turn a deaf ear to everything. Understand this. The tribulation at times has been turned into fun and games. It's been turned into just we're just going to, go out in the wilderness and enjoy ourselves. I can tell you there's going to be a cup that many of us are going to have to drink from. And it will be a cup very similar to the cup that Yeshua drank from himself. Well, he says, but to sit on the right hand and my left is not mine to give. It is for those for whom my Father has prepared it. Now, where would the test be for Yeshua here? Yeshua could have looked at some of these men and said, yeah, sure, no problem. I've got the power to do that. I mean, he is Yud Hey Vav Hey in the flesh. But in the midst of this time that he's teaching the disciples with his words, he's also teaching them with his life. He's teaching them that though he is Yud Hey Vav Hey in the flesh upon this earth, he must also be submitted to someone that is greater than he. And I'm not going to go into the whole thing, and that can be taken as a Trinitarian doctrine. It's not intended to. But I'm not going to go into the whole teaching of who Yeshua is. I think we've done that many times. But what he does, he turns a time of possible testing for him into a moment to show humility. Not just talk about humility. Not just teach about humility, but to actually walk out humility in front of his disciples. Now, when the other 10 heard this, they were outraged at the two brothers, of course. But Yeshua called them and said, you know that among the Goyim, those who are supposed to rule them become tyrants, and their superiors become dictators. Don't we see that today? Among you, it must not be like that. On the contrary, whoever wants to be a leader must become your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. We'll stop right there. These men, along with the mother here, are used to seeing things that are going on around them. They're watching let's put it into our own day. They're watching the Democrats and the Republicans. They're watching the different people in government and in the leadership and in religious circles also. All of them striving for power. All of them striving for position. All of them striving for authority and rule. Why? Not so they can serve another, but so they can be served. So they can become someone of importance. And Yeshua is coming at them with kind of an in-your-face. You are not to judge what my kingdom is going to be like based upon what you see around us. Well, that could never be so. Oh, it's not. Consider some of the teachings, maybe you've heard them, and I have too, of when Yeshua says to me, or when Yeshua says to his disciples, that you will rule and reign with me. And where is that teaching gone to? it's gone to, we're going to be the authority in the kingdom to come. We're going to be the authorities. We're going to be in charge. Everyone's going to have to listen to me. It's the same exact system that we see around us today. I can tell you that in the kingdom, it is going to be a totally different system than you and I have ever experienced in our lives. Why? Because the system that is going to be in place is not going to be like anything that has ever been. It's not going to be like anything you've ever seen in a church. It's not going to be anything like you've ever seen in a messianic congregation, in a community. It's going to be, maybe you and I have gotten at times glimpses of this. But I think the level of servanthood in the kingdom is going to be something that's going to take us a little while to adjust to. This, he goes on here, and he says, on the contrary, whoever among you wants to be a leader must become your servant. And this word here, I believe he was speaking Hebrew, of course. This word is the same word that, as best I could do, would be traced back to Joshua. So when Yeshua says to the disciples, whoever wants to be great among you, whoever wants to be a leader, must become like Joshua. Now, these men understand the person of Joshua. They understood that Joshua had to walk out a servant lifestyle. He had to play second fiddle for the whole time that Moses was in the camp. He played second fiddle. And he had to come to the place in his life that he was satisfied with second fiddle. See, Joshua, I don't really feel Joshua ever desired to have the position of Moses. When in the end of his life, Moses had failed. Moses had struck the rock for the second time. And he went to Joshua and said, you're the one. You're the one that's going to take these people into the promised land. I personally believe that Joshua put up a fight. No, please, sir, go back and ask the Father if he'll give you another chance. I mean, Moshe, you repented. I'm sure that if you went before Yehovah again, that maybe he'd give you another chance. No, I don't want to be the one that takes the people into the promised land. I want you to do it, and I'll be there with you. The same as it has been for all of these 40 years. I don't think that Joshua had a moment cross his mind that he said, yeah, I've just been waiting for Moses to mess up. I've just been waiting for him to mess up so that I can take over as the leader of this community. No. Joshua was, at every moment of his life, satisfied to be second in command, to be just the servant. He was satisfied to be known as the servant of Moses. The second time he says, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. And of course, that word, as I brought out earlier, that word, actually the word slave, brings out so much bad connotation, specifically in America. That's not what the word is. Yeshua is teaching Torah. At every place, we haven't talked about this for a while, but this is my goal, really, in going through the book of Matthew specifically, is to show us that at every place that Yeshua was teaching, he was teaching the Torah. And so what he does is he brings in, if you want to be a leader, look back at the Torah and find out who the man Joshua was. If you want to be a leader, whoever wants to be first must be your slave. The word there is not slave, but is, in Exodus chapter 21, your bondservant. It's the one who is serving willingly. And once again, the bondservant never goes to his master and says, "Ha, I want to be in charge of the household. Look at all this stuff. If I just stick around, if I plot against my master, if I raise up a coup and some kind of rebellion in the household, maybe I can take over." No, the bondservant is content just to be in the house. Joshua was content just to be the person that was able to serve. I believe that he took it as the greatest honor that could ever be bestowed upon a person. And maybe I'm taking this a little far, but I'm going to take it there anyway. Probably through all of Joshua's life, and you can read the whole book of Joshua. There's books, great books are written about Joshua. The exploits, the miracles that were done, the battles that were won. And I just firmly believe that if you'd have gone to Joshua at the end of his life and said, "Joshua, all these battles, the sun standing still, what was your greatest honor of life?" I think Joshua would have probably looked at you and said, "It was being a servant to Moshe, my friend." Being a servant. And get back to that in a moment. No, let's go ahead and do it. Let's go ahead and talk about it a little bit. A servant. Webster defines servant. One who serves others. One who serves others. Webster, you couldn't do any better than that. That's what it is. Got it written down. A servant, one who serves others. Let me give you my definition of a servant. One who places others' needs before their own. That's, to me, a definition of a servant. One who places another's needs before their own. Now, give me a show of hands here. How many of us is that an easy thing for us to do? Let's see. Looking in the camera here, I don't see a single hand. Because I don't have mine up, and that's the only one I can see. This goes against everything that we are. This goes against our very nature. Because our very nature in a fallen state, in the state of Adam, our very nature is self-preservation. Our very nature is, I am first. I need to get what is mine. I need to put my goals ahead of everything else. I've got to look out for number one. And is that what our society is propagating? Everything is about me. Social media, it's about me. Everybody likes me. I have this many people that like me. And I'm not down on all that stuff. Whatever you want to be a part of, it's up to you. That's your decision. I respect your decision, respect mine. But no matter where we go, to the stores, to the internet, to the television, everything is about putting yourself first. You need to take care of yourself. You need to spend some time taking care of you. The scripture says we're to put others' needs ahead of our own. Have I got this one down? I'd love to tell you yes, but I have too many people that I know that listen. And I'd be absolutely lying to you if I said that I've got this one. Am I working on this one? On a daily basis, I'm working on this one. Do I do good? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Just like all of us. Just like all of us. But our model for this is the person of Yeshua, who says, "For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many." Think about it. Could He have come as a king? What's the purpose of the two Messiahs? Messiah, son of Joseph, the suffering servant. Messiah, son of David, the conquering king. What is the purpose of the two? Well, the first one is to suffer for us, so that we could be a part of His kingdom. But wait a minute. He could have come as Messiah, son of David, the conquering king, and He could have made us a part of His kingdom. And He could rule and reign over us and have every right to do so, the same as what we see coming out of Washington, out of New York, out of Brussels, out of whatever country you want to have. He could have come and He could rule and reign over us as a Pharaoh, as a king, have every right to do so. But He came first to suffer and die and be raised from the dead for us, so that His kingdom would be about love. It would be about relationship. It would not be about power, dominion, authority, though He possesses all of those things. It would not be about a group of people that serve Him out of fear. But it would be, in the end, because we see how He served us. He came to serve us, to give Himself as a ransom for us. Our desire is to serve Him out of love. So why, going back to a question, why should you and I desire the return of Messiah? Should it be because He will in the end right the wrongs that have been done? Sure, it's a good reason. Because He will set up an authority and a way of doing things that is according to Scripture. Yeah, good reason. Because there will be no injustice. Yeah, good reason. There will be no pain or sickness. Tears or reason for tears? Yeah, good reason. There will be no debts. Yeah, good reason. Terminal diseases, good reason. Those are all good reasons. But the reason that should drive us to pray for the return of Messiah is because of love. Because there's a void in our lives. Because He's not here with us. We're not with Him. It's, if you've ever, as a married couple, if you've ever had a long period of time that you were away from your spouse, if there's a true covenant and love and commitment there, oh, you can talk on the phone. You can even Skype. It's just not the same as being there. And today, when it comes to the Messiah, we can pray, which is kind of like talking on the phone. Maybe even have some times of intimacy, which is closer to Skype. But He's not here with us. What should drive us today for His return is a void in our lives. because of the love that we have for Him. And if we're walking in that love, you know what we're going to do? We're going to walk like Him. And one of the greatest lessons He taught us is humility, which produces servanthood. What would our life be like today if we could walk that out? What would our marriages be like? What would our communities be like? What would our congregations be like? What would we be like if we desired to put someone else first? Forgetting what the world's teaching us of number one, me first, look out for me, but really put it into practice. Esteeming others greater than ourselves is what the Rav Shaul said. It'd be a pretty good goal for us to deal with. All right, out of time. Shavua Tov. Have a wonderful, blessed, prosperous week. Hope I've given you something to kind of chew on and ponder for a little while. See you next week.
Yivarechach Adonai b'yishmarecha Ya'er Adonai panav elecha b'yichunecha Yisa Adonai Panavelecha Ve'asem lecha Shalom.